You're back with the restaurant guys, Francis Schott and Mark Pascal of Stage Left Restaurant, talking with Marianne Esposito, who is a noted Italian food expert. Hello again, Marianne.
How are you?
Before the break, you were talking about how Sicily is the port of entry, is the key to what binds Italian cuisine, if there is such a thing. I remember from a little that I read just somewhere recently about there being two different cuisines in Sicily. One sort of that came indigenously, and one that's sort of the remnants of French cooking left by the Manzu or the...
Manzu. Oh, you did your homework. Very good.
For an Irish boy, I read a lot about it.
You know, the Manzu...
he's just trying to catch up.
...was hired as someone who would cook for the aristocratic Sicilian. So if you ever read the book The Leopard... you get the sense of what that kind of aristocratic society in Sicily was like. And the Manzu, who was French trained, came to Sicily, and a lot of those dishes Sicilians today would not recognize. But I remember being in a cooking school in Regaliali where there was a Manzu, and one of the dishes I recall that he concocted that night was a chicken in champagne sauce. Now, that would be nothing that an average Sicilian, would eat. So, but basically, the underlying culinary history of Sicily is a hodgepodge. It's something based on one word. It's called agro dolce, sweet and sour at the same time. And it comes from the Arabs, because the Arabs had terrific influence in Sicily. And they brought the whole idea of the open market to Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
So that today when you go to Sicily, you can go to the Vucceria, which is a very famous open market that's based on the Arab tradition. And agro dolce means that there are many Sicilian dishes that have both a sweet and sour taste in them. And you know one very well. It's called caponata.
Of course.
You know caponata, don't you?
Of course.
All right. The eggplant salad has raisins in it. It has vinegar. It has sugar. It has tomato paste. The perfect example of this agro dolce defining culinary part of Sicilian cooking.
This is the caponata.
Caponata, mm-hmm, yes. Yeah. And a wonderful dish with caponata is swordfish with a sauce of caponata over it.
You know, one of the things that's really very interesting is when you talk about people, you know, being a port of entry or a place where a lot of different cuisines came together. Today, in a way, we can look at cuisines of different places, but things can become a little arrested going forward. In the back, when you said the Arabs came to Sicily and cooked their food, they couldn't cook their food. They brought their traditions to Sicily,
right,
but they dealt with Sicilian ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have the birth of these new cuisines, which is what's so exciting about a place like Sicily. It's neither Arab, nor is it what was there before the Arabs came.
Well, you had the Greeks, you had the Phoenicians, you had the Normans, you had the French, you had the Spanish,
mm-hmm,
all of them.
And agro dolce is what sort of separates or distinguishes Sicilian cuisine from maybe the rest of Italian cuisine.
Well, it has a permanence in Sicilian cooking. Yes.
And does the Sicilian cuisine sort of bind all the other Italian regions?
No, not at all.
Well, when we come back, I hope you'll stay with us through the news. And when we come back, I would like to talk about some other Italian regions of food, and I would really like to talk about Italian cooking as it's interpreted by Italian Americans. I think that's a fascinating subject that a lot of our listeners would like to hear about. Will you stick with us?
I sure will.
When we come back from the break, we'll be talking more with Marianne Esposito. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon and reach us through our wonderful and just revamped website, www.restaurantguysradio.com. And while you can tune into us any day, if you're lucky enough to be listening to us today, we're talking with Marianne Esposito. Marianne is host of the PBS program Ciao Italia. She is one of America's most loved television chefs, and with good reason, I might add. Her family's Italian. She holds an M.A. in Italian history. She's the author of 8 cookbooks and teaches in culinary schools throughout Italy. Welcome back, Marianne.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
No problem.
Marianne, you've been on the air for 16 seasons before there was a TV Food Network.
Yes,
there
I know.
Was Marianne Esposito.
It's kind of dating me, isn't it?
Wisdom, Marianne, wisdom.
Yes, you know, when I started, there were no Italian cooking shows. There was Julia Child, mm-hmm. The Frugal Gourmet, and The Galloping Gourmet. And then along came Ciao Italia, and I'm happy to say that it's now the longest running of any cooking show on television.
All right. Congratulations to you.
We've got some really good viewers who've stuck with us these 16 years, but it just goes back to emphasize the point that I made earlier that, you know, we'll never cover the mm-hmm. whole topic.
There's a lot of ground to cover.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, contemporary Italian-American food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our relatives came over, you know, at the turn of the century, and they had their traditions and the foods that they cooked, mm-hmm. and they adapted them to, you know, the foods that were available here, a lot of which were similar,
right.
but adapted them to the foods that were here, and that's kind of gone its own way and evolved its own way. But at the same time, Italian food has continued to evolve.
Yes.
And not necessarily on parallel lines. I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about where you see, you know, them converging and where you see them diverging.
Well, Italian-American food, I think, really got its start, not just with our immigrants coming over and making do with what they could find here, but also I think a big push for that came after World War II,
mm-hmm.
when the GIs returned home,
mm-hmm.
because many of them were stationed in Naples.
Right, so they had a whole new exposure.
Right, so they had a whole new exposure. And they were bringing home stories about the pizza that they had
mm-hmm.
With anchovies and with pepperoni and they were talking about spaghetti and meatballs. And, of course, when they got back, their families wanted to, you know, do these recipes.
Right, emulate as much as they could.
Yeah, right. And so this is how this evolved. But Italian-American food is something that Italians would just not recognize.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced of that. For instance, whenever I see an antipasto in an Italian-American restaurant, I want to gag because, you know, nobody in Italy is going to serve you canned black olives. You're not going to get a wedge of iceberg lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have chunks of cheddar cheese.
Right.
Things like this. And yet, if you are not Italian or you have not had the experience of being in Italy, you accept this
mm-hmm.
as what is Italian food, and thereby, you know, the myth is created. One of my favorite foods that has gone awry in this country are cannoli.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, cannoli are the signature queen of all the desserts in Sicily.
I need to interject an amusing story. You know,
okay,
Mark,
go ahead.
Because Mark is on the quest, always on a quest for
the
perfect
cannoli.
I mean, wherever we go.
Okay.
Maybe
I hit on a good topic.
You did.
It doesn't always serve me well.
And Mark is married to a wonderful, beautiful, intelligent, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant woman who's a friend of mine, but whose family eats everything well done and broiled for a long time. May as well be Irish, right?
Well, you know, people flock to these pastry shops in this country to buy cannoli, and they're these thick lead pipes.
Yeah, and Mark,
right.
You know, dark as dark can be.
And Mark's a debunker of the good cannoli myth.
Right, and they're loaded with some soupy pastry cream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a real cannoli is a thin, blistered, golden brown shell. I mean, really thin, and it's filled traditionally with sheep's milk, ricotta cheese,
mm-hmm.
citron, some pistachio nuts, and maybe bits of chocolate. Now, that's a real cannoli.
Yep, right.
And when you bite into it, it should just shatter down
mm-hmm.
the shirt.
It snaps. That's exactly the story.
So
Francis
we're in Verona. We were to a wine conference called Vinitaly.
Vinitaly, which is going on right now.
I know. We missed this year. We couldn't go for a couple of reasons. But we go pretty much every other year.
You're listening to one of the reasons, Marianne, that we couldn't go.
Yeah, the radio show.
The radio?
Yeah, no, because we have a radio show now. So it was the first time, or the second time we were ever in Verona together, not Verona, New Jersey, but Verona in Italy.
Italy, yes.
And we found this little pastry shop. And Mark, we get some cannolis, and we were walking around in the afternoon, and we had taken an afternoon off from working, and we're walking with Mark's wife, and Mark and I are walking down the street, and we stop and we get some pastries. And Mark takes a bite of a cannoli, and he's speechless, and his mouth is full of cannoli, and he keeps pointing at his face, And finally, what we realize is that Mark wants us to listen to his cheek so we can hear the crunch that's happening,
right.
As if This is what a cannoli is supposed to sound like.
Because it's supposed to just crumble and fall apart.
Absolutely.
That's what's supposed to happen.
That's exactly right. And you would never fill a cannoli shell until you were just about ready to
eat it. Until you eat it. I still don't understand.
Would you dress the salad 6 hours before you were going to eat it?
Exactly the same thing.
Yes. Well, you know, and that brings me to what you were asking earlier about regional cooking. And I always tell people, when you travel to Italy, eat what that region is known for. You don't go to Florence to have pizza. You go to Florence to have bistecca and beans. You don't go to Naples to have steak. You go to Naples to have pizza. Eat what those regions are noted for.
Right.
At one time, you could divide the map of Italy into three distinct regions. You had the north, the center, and the south. The northerners were known as the mangia polenta because they ate polenta and rice. That was the staple of their diet. The central region of Italy, they were referred to as mangia fagioli because they were bean eaters. They ate a lot of cannellini beans. And the southerners were known as mangia macaroni because macaroni was the basis of that cuisine. But what has happened over the last 20 years is that people have traveled and that the infrastructure of Italy has become better and better so that people from the north travel to the south and vice versa. So now you find risotto in Sicily, where at one time you could only find it in the north, and you find Sicilian caponata and tarali and southern specialties in the north, where once you only found it in the south. So travel has made food become kind of all-encompassing all over Italy and Sicily now.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is the Restaurant Guys radio show, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Marianne Esposito, host of the PBS program Ciao Italia and one of America's most loved television chefs. You were talking about how, you know, what's going on in Italy now is the advances in transportation there. Different Italian cuisines themselves are cross-pollinating and moving.
That's right.
One of the things that Mark and I have talked about in the show a lot is how when immigrants move to a new country, like Italian or Irish immigrants, you know, their view of Italian cuisine may change a little for being here, but their vision that gets passed down generationally is a snapshot of something that may be a 100-year-old picture of, in my case, Ireland, and in Mark's case, Italy. And, you know, people tend not to realize that the cuisine, their grandmother's cuisine, continued to evolve in Italy for the last 100 years while we've changed over here. And if you were to go back to the region where that food came from, they're not going to be cooking exactly the same way they were 100 years ago.
Well, I think you've hit on something that's a very disturbing factor in Italy right now, is that it's very true that, the nonas of the previous generations, they were home. They were making food by hand. But the subsequent generations are in the workforce. Women no longer are at home. There's a need for a two paycheck in Italy, so families work so that they're out there in the workforce. That means nobody's home making tortellini or homemade pasta or polenta. So now you go to the the supermercato, the supermarket, to buy these things. And there's a whole generation of Italians growing up not knowing their culture.
Sure.
And I'll give you a perfect example. In the city of Perugia, which I know you have visited, in Umbria, I went into a seed store and I was looking for some zucca seeds.
Actually, you know what, Marianne, can we hold on that for 1 second? Because we do have to take a quick break, but we'll come back and we'll talk about what's going on in Italy with Italian food, and we'll also talk a little bit more about what's going on with Italian-American food as well, or Italian food in America. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:45. 12 noon.